Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. As we've done for many years, at this time we gather the curious group of people who like to know a little bit more about radio and how it works. We discuss what we call the sick net. Starts at 8 o'clock, goes to midnight, most Sundays, and we've been doing that now for 33 years going on, I think it is. 1982 is when it began. Going on 33 and a fraction years. The odometer is turning over, so to speak. Tonight, TechNet is number 1,600. The last two digits turned into zeros. You'll also be hearing the space report from Paul WS2N. And his is number 199 on the space reports. So next Sunday, his odometer is going to turn over, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. The people who gather on at the TechNet Sunday nights are the ones who want to know more about radio. They enjoy ham radio, and it's 26 different kinds of ham radio, and we discuss many of those kinds. 2-meter FM repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26. Arguably, this is one of the most educational hobbies there is. So therefore, before you become discouraged and give it up because your particular kind of ham radio is not pleasing you, try one of the other 25 kinds before you give it up. We've got a very loose schedule that we follow on the TechNet, depending on the enthusiasm and the kinds of questions we get. Each portion of the schedule can be expanded, contracted, and so on. But that very loose schedule is... During the first hour, we take check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment. They sign in and give us their call letters, their name. Try to remember to give me your name, because I like referring to people by name as well as call letters. And the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. So that typically lasts in the vicinity of the first hour of the TechNet. There are times when we get into a great hot subject and we go on for 2 hours. One of the things that might be discussed tonight is that there was a good-sized flea market, I think it's called Nearfest, up in New England. Andy, WA2CDO, and others went, and maybe they'll tell us a little bit about what it was like. I've gone to quite a few of those Nearfests in the past. It's going under a couple of other names. Let me drop it.
You mean Deerfield?
Yeah, Deerfield is one of the things it's called. Nearfest is what I think it's called now. And they gather a good number of people in the vicinity of 10, 15,000 people at a very large facility. And it goes on for a considerable period of time. They start Thursday afternoon and run until Sunday, and the portions of that group are so enthusiastic. They're flea marketing around the clock. You can go out and buy something at 2 o'clock in the morning, if you know what I mean, at Deerfield, Nearfest, or whatever it's called. So maybe Andy will give us a little bit of a rundown of what it was like this year. He just came back in the last day or so. Okay. After the first hour of the TechNet, the next thing we do is to go over to the mailbag. For people who don't yet have the right license or the right equipment to talk to us, I directly, John, WA2CDL, gathers those pieces of information, and John chooses a few of those submittal questions which are of general interest, and we discuss those. That's followed by Paul, WS2N. Let me drop them. Paul is our space expert. He'll tell us the latest in what National Aeronautics and Space Administration is doing, and what the James Webb Telescope is about to do, and so on, as well as the other European and Asian space agencies. Okay, that gives you the very loose rundown. At this time, we're going to take check-ins with people who do have a question or a comment. So give me your call letters and your name. Also, in between each of the transmissions, try to remember to listen for all four beeps. If we don't, then the portions of the machine just get timed out, and people listening on Echolink or IRLP no longer hear what's going on, or we drop out the Eastern repeater. This is 146.85 is also linked to 147.375 on Eastern Long Island. And so those links get dropped if we don't wait for all four beeps. So please give me your call letters and name, because you do have a question or a comment at this time. K2RIW, my name is Dick. We're listening.
WA2RIY, Joe. Yes.
We've got name right now.
Into Exchange.
KQQYC, Ed.
Yeah. Okay, but you have to call it. You're interesting. That, Roy sent me email saying that if he's really needed, he would be available. I sent you the email about, search, all search. Search, sales. So that will be about the, eBay and, Google power stations and other ideas or devices and such.
Not only a matter of control.
Okay, we heard Wes after Ed. Anyone else to check in? Give me a call that has a name right now. Okay, we've got more than enough to get started. I'm pretty sure our president, Joe, I'd like to say a few words, so go right ahead, Joe. W2BMB, K2RAW, the Tech Man.
Take a moment to thank everybody who listens on the TechNet. Because of your RFI reports, I'm sure everybody's heard that one of the notorious jammers was caught by the FCC, and they're continuing with their investigation and further handling the issue with that particular jammer. Did it drop? At the moment, we seem to have the ear of the FCC and some very important officials, but we need numbers, so it's a pure numbers game. So if you hear something, it's very important that you file an RFI report with us. Again, they're looking at pure numbers and how many people it affects. So all you need to do is go to www.limark.org, and right there is the RFI report. It's on the main menu and on the home page. Let it drop. It's very important that you all understand that every single one of these reports makes a huge difference, and that together we can at least address the problem and make a huge difference in keeping the airways clean and safe. Thanks very much to Dick, Paul, and John for running such a fantastic TechNet, and thank you to the listeners who filed the RFI report. Once again, that's at www.limark.org. W2BMP, back to you, Dick. Thanks very much.
Good news, Joe. And I hope the RFI, EMI committee, RFI committee, keeps up the good work. Not necessarily that the only committee doing this work, but looks like the FCC is finally responding more favorably. The next person who signed in with a real question was Joe, W2RYY, and Scientist Joe, what are you into this week, Joe? Which are you investigating the red or the blue electrons this week? I'm having some fun with them. Go ahead, Joe. RYY, K2RAW.
You always like having fun, don't you? W2RYY here. Well, what I did this week was make some measurements of real effective sensitivity on different bands, starting at about 29 megahertz going up. And I made it, my question is going to be why I noticed a difference on one particular band, which happens to be about 10 meters, between a mobile installation and a base installation. But what I basically got on 10 meters was something like about a 22 to 24 dB difference between what the receiver hears nominally by itself and when it's connected to an antenna, what it does. That degraded a little bit up on 6 meters, maybe to about 18 dB. 6 meters, it went up to maybe it was a different radio. It went to like say six or seven dB, and the UHF was about 4 dB. And how I did that kind of measurement was simply using a RF sampler type of T connector, where I put a signal into the connector with first a 50 ohm load on the end of the in place of the antenna, knowing what my receiver sensitivity is going to be initially with a direct connection to the generator. I did it through the key connector because it varies going up in frequency and going down with the loss across the coupler. And once I knew what my sensitivity was going through this tap, then I connected the antenna and had to raise the generator by so much. By so much to see what my level went up to again with the actual listening antenna connected to the device. You got that so far?
Yes, I think I do. Please, please proceed, Joe.
Okay. With the first band I started with, I think I said again, I got about a 24 dB difference. With a receiver that maybe hears about, say, minus 116 dBm's, I had to increase the signal level by about 24 decibels on the generator to get that same level again connected to an antenna. Now, I took that same radio, which is a commercial Motorola radio, with noise blanker, went out to the car and did the same kind of measurement in the car with the generator sitting next to me outside on the ground, and I only got a difference of about 10 to 12 decibels instead of 24. Why do you think that's why I'm seeing that? It was done with the same radio, same T, same generator, but from location A was inside the house, location B was outside the mobile on the same frequency.
Now let me go back to the piece of information you gave me that grabs me the most, Joe. The one that sounds like something is not quite right. I presume it was on 10 meters when you told us that the sensitivity of your receiver, when connected to a 50 ohm source signal generator, was minus 116 dBm. I presume that's in the FM mode, and minus 116 dBm. Minus 107 is a microvolt. Half a microvolt would be 6 dB more than that. And you're talking about the sensitivity in the vicinity of half a microvolt, which is a little bit desensitized compared to a state-of-the-art receiver. Maybe it doesn't have a low-noise amplifier. So let me start right there first. Did you say that in the FM mode, where you probably have in the vicinity of 15 kilohertz of IF bandwidth, rough number, that your sensitivity was minus 116 dBm at 10 meters. Is that one of the numbers you just gave us, Joe? To be 2RYY, K2LAW?
Yes, I used three different radios, actually four different radios, and two of them have very similar sensitivities on, like one on 10 meters is about minus 116. My 6-meter radio, plus another Motorola radio, converted properly for that band, also shows about minus 116. And maybe the 2-meter radio is about minus 118, and the USF radio is 119 to 120 for about 20 dB, almost 20 dB acquired, give or take. But I use those knowing what the sensitivity was to begin with, so I'd have a way of gauging it through this tap, because the tap is obviously going to use. The tap was originally calibrated, the way I originally said it, was about 50 dB loss at about 500 meg, and it goes up as it goes down to UH, it goes down to VHF, and it goes really up quite a bit as it goes down to, like, you know, 30 megahertz, so there's a drastic difference. But knowing that, I, you know, brought the generator up so much according to the, you know, the loss figure, where I could hear the signal again with a 50 ohm termination on the end of my tap. Then I just simply changed the antenna, and I had to bring up the tap, the generator up considerably more in the base installation. And when I brought it after the mobile, it was about a 10 dB difference. It was better, actually, in the mobile. That's where my question lies.
Now, the actual antennas you were using on each of those bands, make a rough guess, Joe, at the frequency where you were measuring, the 6-meter antenna, the 10-meter antenna, the 2-meter, the 450 antenna. What do you believe at the frequency you're testing is the worst possible standing wave ratio of that antenna? Was it as bad as 2-to-1, so to speak? Over to you, Joe, K2LAW.
It was actually very good on the 10-meter antenna. That particular antenna, you're talking SWR, but I'm talking return loss. It's probably better than minus, at that particular frequency, minus 18, minus 20 dB return loss. Maybe a little more than that, about 29 meg. So I go up, I think I tested 29, I was using 29500 as a test frequency. But it's still pretty good because that's a fairly wide band in the antenna down there. 6 meters, the return loss maybe was about gives you what it, you know, approximately what those were. UHF, I didn't measure the internal effect, just using it as a comparison, because that happens to be a directional antenna I could turn and rotate, which actually, when I did a test up on that frequency, it really made no difference where I turned the antenna, because I thought I was hearing, like, you know, maybe like power line noise or something like that from a certain direction, but it made personally no difference. So I don't think the other band would make a difference either as far as directionality.
Now, for the people who are listening, I'm going to try to draw a mental picture of what I think is taking place here. One of the very popular techniques for people to measure sensitivity of, let's say, a repeater system under real working conditions is to put a T connector in the transmission line between the equipment. You've got a rack full of equipment, which is your repeater. It's got a transmission line going to the antenna. In that transmission line, you put this T connector, which has a so-called tapping device. What that really means is that it's a T connector where the third junction, the one going off to one side, is not making good contact. There's an intentional gap there. There's an adjustable screw in many cases, where by a small amount of capacitive coupling, you're able to inject a signal. And the way the laws of physics work is that when you make that tapping device, the third port, lightly enough in coupling, like a 0.01 picofarad of coupling, so to speak, it becomes an extremely large insertion loss between that point and the straight through line. You do that for two reasons. Let me drop. One, you want the straight through line to have nearly 0 dB of insertion loss. Therefore, putting in this tap, and the whole philosophy is that you're making an extremely small perturbation to the system. You're really checking it under working conditions. And to calibrate that tap is not too difficult. By putting a 50-ohm termination on port number 3, port number 2, the one coming off to one side, is where you put a signal generator, and you put your sensitivity as detecting the device on port number 1. Could be a power meter, could be a receiver that's calibrated. You then start cranking up the signal on that tap port, and you might find that it's got, because of such light coupling, it's got a 50 dB insertion loss. The exact insertion loss is not critical, as long as you know what it is to the nearest fraction of a dB. Now, once you've got this thing calibrated to your particular favorite frequency, let me drop. You put this thing into the line while your antenna is really connected. And now on that port number 2, the one coming off to one side, the lightly coupled port, whatever signal generator you put in there, you know that if it's got 50 dB of loss, you've got to crank that signal generator up 50 more dB. If the sensitivity of your receiver, for instance, was minus 100 on the straight through line, you'd have to crank up that signal generator into that port to minus 50 instead of minus 100, 50 dB stronger, in order to start hitting thresholds. So it allows you to measure sensitivity under real working conditions. That works extremely well if and only if the antenna itself has the exact same impedance as the dummy load you put on there when you calibrated this T-connector. If your antenna had, let me give you an example of a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio means that roughly 9.5 dB of the power you send to the antenna, which is roughly 89% or so of the power, comes back, goes to the antenna, and the other 11% comes back to you. Rough numbers, let me drop. So every real antenna with a known standing wave ratio has a reflection coefficient, and Joe has told us those reflection coefficients. But there's one huge missing piece of information. What's the phase angle? I can choose a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio on a Smith chart that allows me to draw a circle where the circle that represents all the possible impedances of my antenna as I sweep it in frequency or as I change a transmission line length, all the dots on that circle, on the far left-hand side of the circle, you'll see 25 ohms. On the far right-hand side, you'll see 100 ohms. Up at the 12 o'clock point, you'll see 50 ohms with some capacitor, some inductive reactants, and so on down at the bottom, capacitor reactants. So depending on the phase angle of the signal reflected from your less than perfect antenna, the actual impedance your antenna presents to that T-connected device could be, in my example, anywhere from 25 ohms to 100 ohms. Therefore, your 50 dB calibration procedure can change by a whole lot, because if the antenna is really representing 25 ohms, when you've calibrated with a 50 ohm dummy load, then there could be close to a 2-to-1 change in voltage that's being coupled between the T-port off to one side and the thing that's measuring signal strength. A 2-to-1 change in signal strength is 6 dB. Let me drop. So the next step of being real scientific here is that if you had a method of measuring the phase, or if you had a trombone, if you had a trombone device that's a kind of a line stretcher that you could put in the transmission line after the T-connected device, and if that trombone could move as much as half a wavelength, maximum in, you'd then be able to see the maximum minimum sensitivity. So what I've just described is a method by which a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna, in the worst case, could give you approximately 6 decibels of error. I think it's plus or minus 6 decibels. However, still, what Joe is reporting to us is way beyond that phenomenon. If I understand correctly, at 10 meters, he's telling us that when he's using a signal generator known to be 50 ohms straight into his receiver, and he measures a certain sensitivity, and then by way of the T-connector, he re-measures the sensitivity when it's connected to the real antenna, and that antenna, he believes, has 18 dB reflection coefficient, which is probably something like 1.2 standing wave ratio. Darn good. Let me drop. He's measuring 24 dB less sensitivity when connected to the antenna. That's a lot. I can see a possible error of as much as 6 dB because of what I just described, the impedance matching problem. However, 24 dB of difference with less sensitivity connected to a real antenna. And I think he said the receiver was minus 116. Does that mean that 24 dB worse than that is like minus 92 or something like that? Is that what you're saying, Joe, is that the sensitivity went to when you connected to the antenna? So run that by again. Was it 24 dB of detriment from minus 116? W2RYY, K2RIW, go ahead, Joe.
W2RYY, yes, on the initial measurement, I measured the, I forget what the loss of the tap was at 30 megahertz, because it changes drastically between where I initially calibrated it to have a 50 dB drop at about 500 meg, because I wanted to use a tap between like, a 1 to 1,000 meg or something like that, and I know it's going to change drastically as you go down to the 30 meg and even lower, because the difference across the tap is much, much higher, like 1,910 dB or so. It goes up pretty severely. But knowing that, I checked the sensitivity, knowing what the receiver is supposed to do with direct connection. I put a 50 ohm termination on the side of the T where the antenna would be. A good 50 dB termination that had a reflection coefficient of at least minus 35 or better. And then I took that off, put the antenna in place, and as soon as I put the antenna in place of it, the signal generator signal just completely disappeared, and I had to bring it up 24 decibels in level to bring it back to the same quieting I had before.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I thought you were telling us, and that's an awful lot. Now, when it comes to the amount of atmospheric noise, and we have had some band openings in the last 24 hours, obvious by the fact that late last night a number of my over-the-air high-definition television, digital TV signals disappeared. Many of my channels disappeared last night. Maybe you saw something similar, Joe. I'm pretty sure we had some kind of a band opening. And they tend to happen with high frequency in May and June at the beginning of late spring and the beginning of summer. The atmosphere does funny things. So that's an aggravating factor. However, if there was a direct signal on that frequency you were listening to, your loudspeaker would have told that to you, and you would have been mentioning that to me. So that's a lot of loss. Now, because your calibration device, let me drop. Because your calibration device has, with its extremely light coupling, 100 dB of loss approximately at 10 meters, that means you've got to turn your signal generator up 100 dB from the receiver sensitivity point when you're going directly into the receiver, as opposed to going through the calibration of the T connector. When you're using your variable attenuator on a well-known signal generator over that big a range, 100 dB of range, you got to worry a little bit about the accuracy of it. Yes, I know that your service monitor is calibrated, and that shouldn't be a factor. But one way to recheck this is that if you're willing to change the coupling coefficient, most of these sampling devices have a screw in there that you can change with 100 dB of loss at 30 megacycles, you might be able to bring it down to something more like 50 and repeat the test and see if you get the 24 dB again. You've got a mystery there. 24 dB of loss is a huge amount of loss of sensitivity. At 80 meters and 40 meters, where the noise figure of the ionosphere, let me drop it. Where the noise figure of the ionosphere can be in 30 and 40 dB, I would understand that. At 10 meters, when there's not a band opening, but was there a band opening? Huh. You may have done this in the last few days, just by what my over-the-air digital television was doing last night. We may have had a band opening, even if there weren't other people on that particular frequency you were tuned to. The fact that the ionosphere maybe was supporting signal at the 28 megacycle region, and because you have hundreds if not thousands of thunderstorms going on somewhere around the world at every second of the day, when the ionosphere is now propagating signals at those frequencies, even though there's not a ham there, all of that noise is coming together and coming into your receiver, coming into your antenna. That's a possible factor. It'd be interesting to see that morning, noon, and night, would you measure the same 24 dB? So I know you've given us numbers for 10 meters, 6 meters, 2 meters, and 450. Just that 10 meter signal alone is alarming. You were alarmed by 24 dB. If you found 6 dB of error, I'd sort of understand it. 24 dB of error, boy, that's a lot. So, do any of your receivers have enough sensitivity so that you could see the actual signal at threshold in the sideband or AM mode to find out all the static crashes in there, if you know what I mean, Joe? W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet. You may not hear that on FM.
J2V to come.
Yeah, just a moment. Now, I only use this on these FM receivers. And I was trying to use these because these receivers have fairly good noise blankers. I'm not sure if you know much about the Motorola noise blanker system, they call it an extender. They work very, very well. You could have noise impulses 8, 10, 12 dB above. You're stronger than your signal coming in. And when you put the blanker on, it'll take them right completely out. That had no effect on this noise at all, this background noise effect of the differential between one level to another level. Other station you popped in, go ahead.
That was Joe, J2B. Go ahead, Joe.
Very good. I'm just trying to get a handle on what he's trying to do here. When he's saying an RF tap, is he talking about similar to, let's say, a Bird Model 40275, which is a 20 to 1,000 megahertz connector that has a screw in, like you said, a capacitive coupling plate inside the T that is adjustable. I have one here that I use to make measurements off the transmitted signal to measure frequency into a frequency counter or spectrum analysis into a spectrum analyzer. It gives you a very, very broad, flat response from 30 to 20 to 1,000. They actually give you a graph. It only varies by a few dBs over that whole range. I would assume he's using some type of a tap like that. And the other thing is, if you're actually putting a signal generator into that tap, that antenna that you're trying to use as a test, isn't that transmitting also? So if you're putting a signal in at a certain frequency and then going to a dummy load, measuring receiver sensitivity, then you're hooking up an antenna and you're still putting in that same signal. That antenna is transmitting that signal along with, off of one side and then going to the receiver on the other side. So unless that antenna is located in an anechoic type of environment, like an anechoic chamber or an open area test site, that signal could reflect back into the antenna and then add to the signal you're trying to measure at the port. So I would think that any reflection near the antenna could adversely affect the accuracy of the reading. I don't know if I'm reading this correctly, what he's saying.
You're telling us about two factors here, but the very first factor is the model number of the type sector. This is a sampling port. Answer that one first, Joe. Are we good, Joe? W-A-2-L-Y-Y, K-2-L-I-W.
I don't recall model number of the thing. They've been around for a long time. I happened to buy this one in the flea market probably about 20-something years ago or more, but they're still currently available. They go for about $90. Typically what you have on these things is interchangeable connectors as far as the path, as far as the through line side. They could be end connectors like male, female. They could be DMC or something else. And the tap off is typically a BNC female. That's that has your adjustability. But I do understand about the reflection factor. But a 24 dB difference between a 50 ohm impedance on the end of the tap compared to the antenna is quite severe. Dick, let me ask you a question. Can I do this a little bit differently by putting a signal out of one antenna on my house and listening to it on another antenna and getting a pamphlet measurement and doing a sensitivity measurement that way where I'm actually not interrupting the antenna circuit whatsoever?
Oh, the answer to that is absolutely yes. You got to worry a little bit about where is the second antenna. If the second antenna is in the shack with you and the first antenna is going up to the roof, as you move your body around the shack, because multipath is everywhere, the signal strength coupling from one antenna to the other is going to go up and down. But if the second antenna is well coupled to the first antenna and not very well coupled to you, that's an excellent technique to repeat the experiment. Now, when it comes to this tapping device, that is an industry standard. People who do two-way radio service frequently use this technique. You could say it's traceable to the Bureau. It's got a lot of history. Used correctly, it gives you a lot of good information. But now, let me approach Joe J2B's second question. Let me drop him. When he's connected to an antenna, there could always be a sneak pass. Every signal generator throughout its capsule, by way of its cabinet, is leaking a certain amount of signal. And when you're making threshold measurements, sometimes the leakage of the signal from the cabinet of your signal generator or service monitor could be going directly into the antenna. And now when you're trying to measure sensitivity, there's really two paths to the signal to get there. One, leakage of the cabinet through the air into the antenna and then into the receiver. And the second path is the desired path where you're going into I'm going to call it the third port. The port off to one side on the T adapter by which you're injecting a signal through a very large attenuator, very light coupling. And so those two different signal paths can beat against each other. But the way Joe worded it, when you go from a 50 ohm termination, the signal that you're injecting, the signal splits two ways. The signal that goes to the right, so to speak, goes into the dummy load, gets absorbed. The signal that goes to the left goes into the receiver and gets recorded. Now when you substitute a known good antenna, yes, the signal going to the antenna is being radiated. If this is the best of all worlds, whether the signal gets radiated 100% because you got a very good low standing wave ratio antenna, or whether the signal gets 100% absorbed because you had a 50 ohm termination there, as far as this coupling device is concerned, that is no difference. A good antenna should absorb all of that signal, and whether the antenna is turning it into heat because the antenna has got a lot of loss, or whether it's radiating it, or whether the signal is being thoroughly absorbed by a 50 ohm termination, as far as this coupling device is concerned, that should be no difference. Once again, as long as there's no mysterious path through the air. Let's see if that made some sense to WJ2B. WJ2B, K2LIW.
Repeater, timeout.
Yeah, we got to wait for the four beats for them to go.
What you're trying to prove with this measurement, because unless you're doing it in a controlled environment, as far as I've done a lot of work with measurements with antennas on open area test site, anechoic chambers for FCC and CE certification of radiating, not intentional radiators, and unless you're doing something like this, I mean, he's really trying to measure either the sensitivity of the with the antenna connected, which background noise, like you said, is if there's any type of propagation or the antenna that's going to affect the measurements. I would think any reflections of the transmitted signal that's going into the coupler goes down the line, like you said, being radiated by the antenna, reflecting off the metallic surface, and then retransmitted back into the antenna. And that signal is going to come back down the line, hit the coupler, and possibly add or subtract to the signal going into the receiver, causing, you know, a big shift in the measurement. So unless that antenna is located in a perfectly unreflective environment, let's say an anechoic chamber, I don't see the validity of this measurement at all. Well, back over to you, Dick, WJ2. Thank you, Jack.
Eric recognized. Joe, what you said has got good common sense to it, and I disagree. You're afraid that the real antenna radiating the signal is going to then reflect that signal off a metallic surface, and it's going to come back at some particular phase angle, and it's going to strongly disturb the measurement. On paper, what you said is absolutely true. Now let's go to the real world. When that antenna is in front of that piece of metal that's reflecting a signal, if the reflected signal is of significant magnitude, it has to change the apparent bending wave ratio of the antenna. Bending wave ratio really is reflection coefficient. So that if you send a signal to the antenna, as Joe did, and the signal coming back is 18 dB suppressed, 18 dB reflection coefficient, whether that 18 dB is reflection off a piece of metal, or whether it's the true visor of the antenna, that still is extremely close to a 1.2 to 1 or so bending wave ratio. Therefore, that factor in this case may not be major. So the reflection of the metal would have to show up as visor. If he's measured the visor in the environment of the antenna, that's good enough. Yes, the anechoic chamber is a better method, but you and I could now go through the numbers on this technique, and we're not going to find 24 dB of error. We're going to find half a dB of error, if you know what I mean. That's not what Joe is looking for. KE2EJ, let's see what Joe is, what's D, here we go, what Eric's going to say. You got it, Eric, K2LIW. K2LIW,
K2EJ, what you just brought up a few things that I was going to say, but in my experience, I have a number of the bird devices. I use them regularly for a lot of different things, but what I've done, what I've discovered, especially setting up a fuse, doing stuff like that, I agree with the other fellow, is that what's the validity of the measurement? You know what the receiver is doing, and the rest of it's all the antenna system. But what I do have to say is that I've done some experiments like that with a trombone, and of course, you're not going to get any antenna with a tenor wire that's, you know, in the 50s or 60s. So any little bit of reflected energy is going to come back at a different phase angle. And as I've adjusted the trombone, I can see a difference as I adjust the trombone, because there's a certain amount of energy that's being reflected back. Forget about the outside environment, just the visual of the antenna to the transmitter. Although the numbers that we're talking about are a bit much, you know, and also, I don't know what kind of device he's using, but I've used some other devices that are not linear. You know, you change the frequency, they have a bit different law. Whereas, of course, you can readjust it and make it exactly the same, you know, when you sweep it. But then, of course, you're doing that in a perfect 50 ohm environment. Change the impedance a little bit, and you're going to get different results. K2IW, change it again.
Now, let me pursue that a little bit, Eric. Assuming you were using a medium good antenna, like 15 dB reflection coefficient, 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio, or better, and then you did your trombone measurement with this sampling device. I am guessing as you operated the trombone, you saw maybe a dB of increase or decrease. My guess is you didn't see anything like 24 dB of change. Roughly, what do you remember on a good antenna with the variation in sensitivity as you operated the trombone, Eric? K2EJ, K2LIW.
Actually, I remember exactly. A well-tuned antenna, doesn't really change much. You know, maybe a dB, dB and a half. Antenna that's tuned to a different part of a band, I've seen differences as much as plus or minus 90 dB.
That seems to make a lot of sense. So, we're not trying to find out how perfect this test was. We're trying to find out where is this big discrepancy coming from. We can account for a dB of variation because of line length if it was a good good antenna. And a good antenna would mean that in the working environment, with the reflections of nearby chunks of metal, if the antenna gave you something like a 1.5 standing wave ratio, then we know how much reflected power is coming back. And by the way, to really calculate this, you got to calculate reflected voltage, because believe it or not, whenever you got more than one source of signal going into something like a receiver, or going into more than one source of signal from two different paths going into an antenna, we ham radio operators and engineers think in decibels of power. Mother Nature doesn't. She always thinks in voltage. You take the voltage from signal generator number one and the voltage from path number two, and you add those voltages together in a vector manner, meaning you're keeping track of the phase and adding those voltage vectors. So even with that voltage characteristic, 24 dB is a big error. And so something else is going on here, Joe. If you did repeat the experiment, let me drop.
So that's the V in SW1.
24 dB of error in sensitivity between test number one and test number two on the same receiver with this sampling device. I consider that an awful big number. I'm not quite sure what you're saying, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
24 dB, Joey. And the maximum that I've seen is when a really, really detuned antenna is around 90 dB.
And if you saw a peak to valley of 90 dB, by way of the mathematics that I presented in that article on using directional couplers, and you can find that article on each of the websites that we took.
The sampler is not a directional coupler.
I accept that. What I'm getting at is the procedure of adding two signals together that are in phase or out of phase by way of mic number one or mic number two's website. Mic number one is amateurradio.tangovictor. Mic number two is limotechnet.com. And either of those, you'll find an article by K2LAW about making directional coupler measurements to measure visuar. Okay, even though this device is not a directional coupler, although it's an extremely light coupler, it's a 30 dB, 50 dB coupler, 100 dB coupler, it has many of the same characteristics. But the way you add two signals together, that same procedure will work, if you know what I mean. And you'll find out that where you gave me 9 dB of peak to valley, and if you were using the trombone correctly, let me drop. From that experiment, by way of that mathematical procedure, I could tell you exactly what was the standing wave ratio of that antenna at your test frequency. The raw data is there because the 9 dB of peak to valley was something like plus 4.5 dB in the positive direction, minus 4.5 dB in the negative direction. And the positive direction is when the two voltages were in phase. The negative direction was the two voltages were out of phase. How small was the second voltage that'll give you that much perturbation? That's a relatively simple mathematics. Once you do the anti-logging and get them into real voltages, now you're adding and subtracting voltages. Do you see what I'm saying on that one there? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Absolutely, Dick. And if I had the same amount of energy coming back as I was sending out, of course, you know, like with 180 degrees out of phase, which is nothing, but that's not the case. I agree with you. I actually never bothered to do it mathematically. It was just, you know, something I was doing in passing.
Now, it turns out that I got a whole lot of credit and some awards way back in the dark ages when I was trying to find out where the mysterious echoes were coming from. In one of the world's largest anechoic chambers, the Benfield Anechoic Facility out at Edwards Air Force Base in California. They were getting some mysterious echoes. It turns out they were coming from the anechoic material itself, but I could find out what the peak to valley was, and therefore, from that I could find out how strong was the echo off of the anechoic material. And by removing the anechoic material and having nothing but flat floor in that particular environment, where there was a grazing angle signal, so to speak, it made a huge improvement. So you can use the peak to valley as a way of finding out how strong is the mysterious signal that shouldn't be there. So in your case, Joe, if you do use a second antenna that is not coupled to you, in other words, there's a second antenna some other place in the house, maybe else also on the roof, and you measure the insertion loss between the two. And now that is your new T-connector of calibration, if you know what I mean. By that means, you can now confirm or deny, is the 24 dB a real number, or is there something funny going on with that coupling device, plus the way it's being hooked up. The test, let me drop it. The test that you're doing is an industry standard among people who do two-way radio measurements and sensitivity measurements and service. So you're using a procedure that's traceable to the bureau, so to speak. But those results are really crazy. So I guess and by the way, the second antenna that you're using to transmit to the first antenna, the second antenna doesn't have to be on that band. Doesn't have to be a low visual antenna. Doesn't matter what it is per se, as long as you're coupling to it by way of, let me pick a number, a 10 dB pad. So it's real visual, it doesn't matter. It's just another way of injecting a signal into the antenna, which comes closer to an in vitro measurement. In other words, the real measurement before you added anything like this coupling device, which is a minor perturbation. Over to you, Joe. W2RYY, K2LAW, the TechNet.
Well, you're absolutely right. I saw this isn't my invention, or you know, that I thought of, my idea. I actually saw this in some early Motorola technical publications on measuring sensitivity of communication systems. That was published in either early or mid 70s. I don't have the paperwork. I just happened to read it at one particular place where I was working a long time ago. There was some paperwork that happened to just get, you know, glance through, and that's a pretty cool way of measuring it. So I just, you know, use the same method as I said. But the next time I'll bring up, what I'll do by for next week is I use another antenna elsewhere outside the house. I do understand that you can't, I could put an antenna inside the house and go down outside, because me working around even a slight bit would change the reflection from point A to point B. I'll have to do it outside and make a measurement over a length of time to see if the sensitivity, if the signal actually changes in decibels by any large fraction, small fraction, whatever, and take that into account with my measurement. But I'll come back next week with a different type of measurement to see if I get the same thing or not.
Jay, to be with another comment.
Okay, Joe number two. Actually, you're Joe number three. That'd be J2B, you're right ahead, Joe. J2RYW.
J2B, I'm still having a hard time grasping the validity of the measurement, especially, you know, being that the antenna is not in a controlled environment or an anechoic chamber, because all you're trying to do is measure receiver front-end performance, and that can be affected. The difference between having it hooked up to a dummy load with the T and then having it on an antenna with the T, the antenna could be receiving out-of-band signals, even if you're not hearing something right on the frequency that you're using, an out-of-band signal, let's say a strong transmitter on a frequency that's within the front end of the radio, could desense the front end of the radio and screw up your measurement. So that's why I'm having a hard time grasping how this measurement has any validity at all, unless it was the antenna is actually located in an anechoic chamber that there's no out-of-band signals affecting the receiver or anything along those lines. I know you think about that, WJTV.
Can I make a comment on all this? The point of this whole test is very, 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 very simple, okay? You can test the receiver with a signal generator and come up with a measurement of what kind of sensitivity the receiver has. Now, if you had that same level signal actually available at the input of the coax cable to your radio, and you plug that antenna into your radio, would you hear that signal, or the background noise mask it out? That's what I'm trying to prove out with this experiment.
Background noise could be coming from a number of sources external to the antenna, or somebody with a motor or hair dryer, anything that's in the vicinity of that antenna could be producing noise that's covering your signal that you're trying to measure, and it's going to make the sensitivity, you know, appear to be worse when it actually isn't.
Yeah, hold on a minute here, Joe. I think you're misunderstanding Joe number two, Joe number three, J2B. That's exactly what Joe number one, RYY, is trying to measure. He knows the noise of the atmosphere, the noise of extraneous signals, the noise of vacuum cleaner motors in the neighborhood and whatever. All of those can desense his receiver. That's exactly what he wants to measure. How much desense am I experiencing with my antenna in this environment at my QTH? And if he, in this particular case, if the 24 dB of desensitivity of antenna versus dummy load measurement turns out to be real, the next step I know Joe will be doing is find out where the hell is that coming from. Is 23 dB of it, so to speak, atmospheric, because there's a zillion thunderstorms going around and in the world somewhere, and the ionosphere happens to be in a mode which is coupling those signals today, or is it all of the man-made noise in his neighborhood, and so on. My understanding is that that's exactly what Joe wants to measure. How much desense is he experiencing at 10 meters, so to speak, in his environment? And so, if the antenna was in a perfect anechoic chamber, and if the antenna was exactly a 50-ohm load with a very low standing wave ratio, then whether you put the antenna on that port of the sampling device or put a 50-ohm dummy load, there would be no difference. That wouldn't tell him how much descent he is experiencing in his neighborhood. That's what I think he really is trying to measure. Am I correct on that one, Joe? W2RYY, K2RIW, and the second net.
You are exactly correct.
Yeah, now, yeah, Eric, KE2EJ, go right ahead.
Hi. I've done something along these lines. Not for the reasons that Joe is doing it, but what I would suggest to him, because the other Joe brought up a couple of good points, being in an uncontrolled environment. You want to remove some variables. You might find it a little hard to do at 10 meters. You might even find it hard to do at 6 meters, but you should do it pretty easily at 2 meters and 440. And that takes cavity, or takes a series of cavities, and bring the area not of interest, you know, 60 or 70 dB down. Take the insertion loss and calculate the insertion loss through, or sweep it through the filters that you're using, and start there. Because most of these radios, the front ends are so broad, and they really don't have that much of a pre-selective, quote-unquote, because they need to go, you know, they need to have wide tuning ranges. Of course, there are radios from Motorola that are really expensive that have Veractitune front ends, but you got to cut some of the variables out in order to figure out what's really going on.
K2RIW, K2J.
Let me make a comment, Dick. This test was done, all three frequency bands, or actually four frequency bands, it was done with a Motorola commercial mobile radio used in the house or in the car. So I'm not using something like a Jap radio, which is, prone to getting overloaded by something 30, 40 megs away. That's just killing it. Motorola makes a pretty good package as far as mobile radio goes, and the front end sensitivity is meant to work across the whole wide range of frequencies without it being overloaded by out-of-band traffic.
Not completely true.
Okay, let's step by a second. What I think that Joe is saying is that the Motorola radio, in theory, has a moderately good bandpass filter. Yes, if I was doing this with a Baofeng, which tunes DC to light, or a Muxong, any of these, you know, $30 radios, boy, out-of-band signals can drive those things crazy. I'd like to believe out-of-band signals in Joe's case was not doing it, but that's something else to be investigated, a better bandpass filter, and whether or not his system with that antenna can respond to so-called out-of-band signals. He can find that out by using his service his service monitor as a sweeper, and sweep all the frequencies, so to speak, and find out where the radio responds. So, what Eric is recommending is that we put in another bandpass filter, a good-sized cavity, to make sure that only the desired frequency is coming through. Considering what radio he's using, I think that's a long shot as a problem, but that's one more test to be done. KE2EJ for further comment. K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
No, I've worked on a lot of different Motorola radios, and there are some radios that are really tight, and they really have a very narrow tuning range. They've actually gotten away from that in the later model radios. Typically, the ones that operate at VHF have helical resonators in the front end. And as you know, given the physical size, there's a limit to how tight you can make them. And there's also the the business aspect of it, that you want to sell one version of radio as much as possible. Although you'll see that they make a radio that goes from 400 to 450, and one that goes from 440 to 470. You'll see that slot of, you know, 20 or 30 megahertz worth of bandpass on each one of those radios. And if you actually check the sensitivity at various different parts of the band, you'll know damn well that you have to tune the thing in, bring it up to peak sensitivity, and you get a pretty consistent result. But, you know, it's like anything else. There's economics involved, so just the fact that it's Motorola doesn't really mean anything. You want to go back, you know, 10 years or 15 years before they started making them elsewhere and tried to reduce their costs because the company split up. You know, they used to be a much huger company, but the radio division is still the radio division. They don't have the support of what they used to have. So things change. But let me let it drop. Really, I understand completely what he's trying to do, and it's what's really valid is to see what his environment is doing to him. As you damn well know, that when you hook the generator straight into the radio, for the most part, you're pretty clean. You don't have any external stuff happening. Once you hook it up to an antenna, you can't say, well, you know, this antenna is only going to pick up this one frequency, because you've got natural noise from the earth. You've got other signals that don't even have to be near the bandpass. I can show you some examples of problems where you'll get NMR, when you get mixing of stuff from frequencies that are completely unassociated with one another, and that'll be after the front end of a radio. So, you know, reduce your variables, you'll start to get a real result, a real valid result in terms of what's happening when you connect to this environment. Whereas that this setup, really, if you have a reference antenna and you're diddling antennas like you do, Dick, it's a good way to tell gain and things like that in a pretty reasonable environment. But without, you know, removing some of the environment that you're trying to measure, you're going to get different results at different times, even. Kids will always love you, KHSK.
I got one last standby. I got one last great question for you, Joe. On any of those bands, did you get a chance to test more than one antenna with that testing procedure? Like maybe the rooftop antenna on 10 meters and a mobile antenna on 10 meters, or a rooftop antenna on 2 meters and a mobile antenna on 2 meters. Whenever you measured with the second antenna, maybe one was mobile and one was fixed at home, did you get the same 24 dB, so to speak? I know that was only the 10 meter number, but you know what I mean. So when you change the antenna, did the decibels of discrepancy change substantially? W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet?
Yes, it did. I told you that at the beginning. I tested one radio, and by the way, this radio has an operating range of 29.7. This is what the factory says. 29.7 to 36 megahertz. So if I'm testing at 29.6 to 29.5, I'm still within the best bandwidth of the receiver. It's not going to, you know, fall flat on its face. I'm only 200 cc's away from a stated, you know, specification. So the thing, for all practical purposes, has a little over 6 megahertz bandwidth on the low split radio. Well, yeah, I took that same radio, tested with the coupler and the signal generator the same way out in the mobile, and I only got a difference of about 10 dB. I picked up about 10 dB of apparent sensitivity doing the test out in the mobile with a mobile antenna that was fairly resonant for that band, because that was brought up for another subject many, many months ago, being testing antennas these different length antenna rods to get it resonant. And I obtained that, and I got the antenna resonant, where it's, you know, quite usable on like 29.6. So I did do the test out in the mobile, and I only had to bring up the generator about 10, maybe 12 dB. So there was at least a 10 dB difference.